Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
On the night of the 3rd of February 2007, I was driving down from Derry to Belfast under a blood-red moon. It was the opening round of the National Football League, and 100 or so miles away in Dublin, 81,678 people had packed into Croke Park to watch the first ever floodlit GAA match. It was said to be the largest attendance at any sporting event in the world that weekend. I'd toyed with the idea of going, but not being from either Dublin or Tyrone, I contented myself with listening to it on the radio on the journey down. And the man describing the action was the great Micheál Muirahearty. As we approached the blue bridge that spans the River Ban, marking the border between County Derry and County Antrim, I said to the kids, "Look at the moon!" And this extraordinary crimson moon was hanging in the sky, and we all looked up in wonder and amazement. Four travellers on the road, suddenly aware of their own smallness in the world. And in the most extraordinary bit of serendipity, I suppose, at that exact moment, Micheál came up with one of the greatest passages of commentary I have ever heard. He said, and I'm remembering this, "And as I speak, a blood-red moon has risen over the Cusack stand, almost like a celestial dugout, where the great players who have graced this legendary pitch over many years can sit and enjoy this unique and historic encounter." And I said to the kids, "That's the same moon. It's the same moon he's talking about." And I thought to myself, what an amazing bit of description. To pull that unforgettable image of a celestial dugout from somewhere in your mind, live on the radio, and that idea of the great footballers of yesteryear sitting up there watching this floodlit match. I mean, whether you were in the Hogan stand or in a car with your kids 100 miles away, it was pure poetry. I'm a great believer in the idea of never meeting your heroes. Anytime I've been tongue-tied and hopeless and unable to ask the questions I wanted to ask. But 3 years later, I got a chance to chat with the great Micheál. It was in the run-up to the All-Ireland final that year, 2010, Down were playing Cork. We had won 5 All-Irelands in previous years and never been defeated in a final, although the last one had been a few years before. So there was great excitement in the county. And I managed to get a radio interview with the great man. We met in a hotel in Kildare, and although he gave me his undivided attention for more than an hour, I kind of shared Micheál with everybody who walked past, shook hands, and regaled him with their own memories of heroic victories and should-have-beens. We talked about his native Kerry, about his route into broadcasting, and some of the great occasions he had seen and worked on over the years. I mentioned to him about the unforgettable bit of commentary I remembered from 2007 about the celestial dugout and the historic occasion. And although he remembered all the details of the match, he brushed off modestly any talk of his own incredible gift for words. At the end, I asked him who he fancied for the final. He reckoned that Cork would have too much for Down. And naturally, I wasn't impressed, but I bowed to his superior knowledge and finally plucked up the courage to ask him the big question about how long he'd go on commentating on All-Ireland finals. And Micheál said, "I think I know when is the time to go." We had a pot of tea, I got a photo, we shook hands, and he disappeared into a Kildare car park while I headed back up the road with a great radio interview in the bag and a big smile on my face. An hour up the road to Belfast, my phone started ringing with numbers I didn't know. So I pulled in and went through the messages. Sports journalists I knew but didn't really know, congratulating me on getting the big scoop about Micheál. And I thought, Wow. How did anybody even know I was meeting him? And was it really such a big scoop? Well, turns out that it was, because that very same lunchtime, Micheál had announced to someone, not to me, that this All-Ireland final of 2010 was indeed to be the last one he would commentate on. Announced it either just before or just after I'd chatted to him. So I'd spoken to the man of the moment, had an unforgettable morning drinking tea with him, but managed to completely miss the scoop. My naivety or Micheál's craftiness? Never meet your heroes.
They call him Barefoot Ted, an American hero who has run marathons all over the States on all kinds of terrain in his bare feet. Ted says the first time he ran without shoes, it was like his feet were fish jumping back into the water after being held captive. I read about him in Born to Run, a book that anyone who hangs around running clubs will hear about sometime. Ted may be the reason I'm sat here in the car, in my running top and shorts, by the Mornington Dunes. I don't want to get out. I sit for a while, procrastinating, the car a cradle gently rocking in the breeze. I check Instagram, Twitter, Gmail. Finally, I get out and feel the angry breeze on my legs, goose pimpled and complaining. I take my runners off and throw them in the back seat and step barefoot through the vast sand dunes. On the strand, I twist the creaks from my ankles and start to run. Running barefoot, I feel the slap of my feet against the million minuscule grains of sand, the textures beneath my sole. This is my foot striking off of the land. No uncertainty, no millimetres of rubber insoles or air bubbles masking the impact. Why do we need shoes when our feet are ready-made? I first walked barefoot in these dunes when I was suffering from plantar fasciitis, a tightness of the muscles in the legs and feet that causes severe pain in the soles. It made running impossible. I tried rolling my feet over rubber balls and empty bottles, but nothing was making them better. I couldn't run. The frustration of not being able to run is known to every injured runner. Seeing people jogging as I drove past them infuriated me. Feck them and feck my stupid feet. I came across advice to walk barefoot on rough ground as a cure. So I took myself down to Bettystown Beach in East Meath, a few minutes' drive from Drogheda, took off my shoes and went for a walk. I loved the feel of my feet on the ground. I felt I was going back to something I'd done as a child. For the first few strides on Bettystown Beach, I'm sure this will be an easy run. Just stretch out your legs and run. But 30 seconds in, my body protests, more air, more air. I have to open my mouth to inhale, suck it in as another breath rushes out. My breathing is arrhythmic and scattered. My strides are self-conscious. What is this? My body yells. All day sitting and now this? Why? There's nothing to run from, nothing to chase. A minute or two and the body recovers. Again, the precocious confidence. Ah, this is easy. I've got this. I must be 1 kilometre into a 5 kilometre run and I feel great. Fleeting thoughts go through my mind. Random tune fragments, lyrics from songs, chores to do. No pattern, awkward strides. My watch vibrates. 1 mile done. Almost 1/3 complete. Not bad. The first time I ran barefoot, I was surprised how good it felt. My feet weren't bruised or bleeding. I didn't break a toe or cut my soles. My feet felt free, in contact with the naked earth, feeling its curves and uncertainties. Every step sent information into my body, grass, rocks, mud, puddles, all earth, Mother Earth. I reached Laytown, then turned to head back. I realised the wind, which has been blowing me down the Strand, is now my foe. My breathing is deep and loud. I seem to be running through treacle. I feel every stride. I begin to look for landmarks, conscious of the distance still to go. I am fighting my body and mind to keep going. And then, a hit of dopamine leaves me elated. I could run forever. If heaven is an eternal run, I could die now. Sometimes in the wind or rain, you just fall in love with running. The mist on your face, the solitary battle with life, the struggle and the reward. Sometimes you've just got to whoop out loud to yourself or to the universe, "Woohoo! I'm alive!" 2 miles done, just over one to go. The third mile broken up into parts. One more stride and one more and one more and then it's over. I'd been running barefoot for 6 months on the beach, sometimes in the twilight when I couldn't see my feet, trusting my sense of touch without a care. One morning in the bright sunlight, I saw a glint on the sand. Something green. I stopped to pick up a small piece of bottle glass and put it in my pocket. A little further on, I saw another. This time a triangle of transparent glass, and further on another sand-worn semi-opaque piece. I'd been unaware, but now as I ran with head scanning the ground, I would pick pieces up and put them in my pocket. They always lay flat, so if I did step on one, they would just be pushed into the sand. The glass I collected I would throw into an old straw hat in the boot of my car. I eventually had quite a collection. I took a photo of my glass haul beside my bare feet and put it on Instagram with a warning not to throw glass bottles into rivers or streams, and I hashtagged barefoot running. An hour later I checked Instagram to see that none other than Barefoot Ted had liked my photo. It was like David Bowie recommending your song. I was elated. I was part of the barefoot running community, officially.
The space around my house has become an aerial construction site. From first light, the builders can be heard trilling and calling, transporting lumber heavy for their size with agility. Nest building season is underway. These discerning builders know which twigs, mosses, grasses and tufts of feathers will make the most solid and safe of homes. Structurally sound and snug, these are feats of delicate engineering. Soon the builder's young will arrive, but first they must ready the nest. Despite my fears about the wider world, the garden is a frenzy of homemaking. The crows are as noisy as ever, cackling almost as they fly past with sticks, making spiky-looking nests in the high, steady branches of the oaks and sycamores by the riverbank. I watch as they give chase to the buzzards who'll happily steal an egg from their nests given half a chance. At first light, a pair of grey herons take flight, swooping low over the river to begin the day's fishing on Loch Foyle. At dusk, they'll call to one another in their trumpety voices and fly back to their nest deep in the woods. Once I thought I caught sight of it, high in the trees, bigger than any nest I'd ever seen. But despite their size, the herons are secretive, and I can't be sure. Among the bluebells now in bloom, I find a pale eggshell, split open. What delicate creature came out of here, I wonder? But there's no sign of a nest among the trees. I hold the shell up to the light. It's almost translucent, and I take it back to the house to place it gently on my desk where I write, a reminder of the world being reborn day by day. Since childhood, the wonder of finding an abandoned nest, chicks long flown, has not abated. As a 10-year-old, I happened upon one with speckled blue eggs in a dry ditch and worried my very looking at it meant the mother bird wouldn't come back to sit on her eggs. I never could find the same place again and could only hope that the songs I heard from my bedroom window were the chicks coming to tell me they'd made it. Many Septembers ago, my youngest son arrived into the kitchen, reverently carrying something in his hands. He held it like he would a bird, gently, as if it would disintegrate if he handled it too roughly. But this little construction was tough. Dried moss, pieces of lichen and grass bound together. Inside, it was lined with delicate grey feathers and hair, a miracle of engineering, fit for a songbird. While the moss has turned a golden brown colour from age, the beauty of this long abandoned nest has not withered, and the day of the nest finding is part of our family's lore, the nest an heirloom of the most delicate and precious kind. In times of trouble, I find myself holding it. It's a comfort to know that something so beautiful could be created out of so little, that the natural world has depths of knowledge and powers of creation that we can't even imagine. My favourite builder is the robin. I can see a female hopping into a hedge planted at the back of the house long ago, but I'm afraid to get too close for fear I'll put her off and she'll go elsewhere. Instead, I put some of her favourite mealworms on a nearby feeder to keep the mother nourished after her maternity. In the old boat shed, the remnants of swallows' nests remain stuck to the rafters. Like pieces of wizened pottery, they cling to the wooden beams long after their inhabitants made them. High in the apse of the roof, I can see the new nest our swallows have built. My family and theirs, indelibly linked through the generations in this place that is both of ours. I fret over the nesting birds too. We are surrounded by foxes and badgers, and these nocturnal creatures would make hasty work of a nest built low to the ground. I can see by the tracks in the woods that they are also busy crisscrossing through the bluebells and on the hunt for food, turning up the soil with sharp claws for tasty morsels. Only recently I wandered close to the den of a fox, only to find a sea of grey feathers, all that remained of a wood pigeon. The birds are singing loudly these evenings, a call to let other birds know they are here, that this is their place, before they grow quiet and settle into their nest for the night. As I listen, I think of warm, cosy nests, safe from predators. I imagine a soft place to lay eggs. A place of chicks thriving, of new generations of birds bringing flights of hope to a broken world. Baby birds are a cause for rejoicing.
En mi jardín ha crecido una flor, no sé su nombre, no conozco su olor, pero con ella paso los días, las confesiones.
The American Embassy in Ballsbridge opened its doors 60 years ago, on May 23, 1964. I've always loved that building, so I went to see its creator, John Johansson, in New York back around the turn of the millennium. He was an old man, almost alone, when I called by the tall, dusty office off Union Square, full of slanting, greenish light, busting through the shades of other days. Old New York. He still came down from upstate to the city by train once a week. I reckon not too many people called by anymore. He seemed somehow grateful for my small courtesy, the privilege he had kindly granted. Shortish but big-boned, with a skull that seemed sharp on top like a cleaver, he wore a hard preacher's beard. He must have been a fearsome Harvard Crimson in his youth. All-American too, soccer team captain. His voice was rich and sonorous, with a Yankee blue-blood accent you don't often hear these days. To my surprise, he didn't really care to talk that much about the embassy, except to recall his admiration for the skill of Crampton, the builders who assembled the 1600 precast concrete elements with quarter-inch gaps between them all the way round. Instead, the long table we sat at was strewn with futuristic visions of when, rather than building, we might program and grow a new species of architecture through innovations in molecular nanotechnology. Resolutely face forward, Johansson remained a fearless architectural frontiersman, scouting new ground all of his days. As with work, so in life. A former employee, Dick Bergman, remembered his playful and mischievous side. He was a rascal. He was arrested once for swimming nude in the reservoir with his secretary. He was an acrobat too. He would amaze people at parties at his house, which was a big glass box on stilts. He'd stand by an open window, put his martini down, and do a backflip out the window and land on his feet. But in Washington, he nearly missed his mark. His first design effort for the embassy, a square, was shot down. His second, hexagonal, tipping a nod to the giant's causeway, was rejected. Three strikes and you're out. The embassy became a political football in Congress before he finally found the circular form with its allusions to ring forts and the alluring bony cladding architect John Toomey calls precast knitwear. Johansson explained its success. The circle turns its back on nobody. President Kennedy, newly elected, greenlighted the embassy, although he didn't live to see it open. By coincidence, Johansson had been a contemporary of JFK at Choate, Connecticut's elite prep school, and later at Harvard. The Dublin embassy, nearly half of it underground, was always more than a trade and green card operation. This was a friendly Cold War project, designed and built around the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the length of Shannon's runway was potentially of critical strategic value in the West's struggle for supremacy with the USSR. John le Carré's The Spy Who Came In from the Cold came out in 1963 and spelt it out for all to see. Later filmed in Dublin too, Derelict Smithfield standing in for war-torn Berlin. And TV had arrived in 1961, bringing Lucy and Bilko and countless sunny square-jawed cowboys into every sitting room in Ireland. Hard and soft, these opposite perspectives inform the two remarkable series of drawings Johansson made for the embassy. One, the hyper-precise ink drawings that lay each precast concrete component out on a slab like an Airfix model, a machine part, a military piece, a gun. The other, evocative, revealing another reality, sketches full of shade and men shifting in the shadows of the rotunda, always watching. A place where madmen and cold concrete collided. John was a metaphysical romantic. Newgrange, with its metaphor of rebirth, was a favourite site of his. He held out for light, joy and optimism, rather than the dark shadows from which he had conjured those cloak and dagger images that exposed for us a parallel truth hiding in plain view. His filigree, Aaron Weave mannerist masterpiece in Ball's Bridge, is the epitome of Brehon brutalism. A few years after he died, I guided two thoughtful ladies in nondescript gabardine coats around the embassy. Mellie Johansson, John's first wife, the former Mary Lee Longcope, descended from both the founder of the Yale School of Medicine and Abraham Lincoln's Secretary of State for War, along with their daughter Deborah, had both missed the opening. They were now on a pilgrimage of sorts, seeking out a connection with something from long ago, while quietly marking the centenary of John's birth in 1916. The weather was not kind. It was June, and we had hoped for sunshine. Alas, the vagaries. I hope they found, if not what they were looking for, at least a worthy alternative, a sense of a different America, one utterly changed from the optimistic blue sky era of Camelot, but which remains essential in these dark and dismal days.
I'll say goodbye to all my sorrow, and by tomorrow I'll be on my way. I guess the Lord must be in New York City.
Me and Mags McAvoy, walking down the main street in Tramore, wearing the same Levi's and T-shirts, except her top is nicer, red, with the image of an afro-haired guitarist on the front, whereas mine is yellow, with the racing car zooming across my breasts. But she spotted the red one first, in the bargain bin in that Dublin jeans shop. She slips off her braces and pushes them into her pocket. Our noses lift, sniffing vinegar, lard and salt in the air. Will we have chips or chalk ice? Even after the big dinner her mother made in their holiday home near the top of the Donnerill Walk. We decide on a chalk ice, snapping the crisp, cold chocolate with our teeth, leaning on the jukebox, listening to Lizzie over the dring of the slot machines, coins falling, the shush and crash of the bumpers. Her brother Billy joins us, and even though we're too early, we wander on down to the Atlantic Ballroom. Inside there are guys playing with a football table, slamming the balls into the goals. Jesus, Billy says, that's Brian Downey. Then, how are you girls? Do you want to play ball? Phil Linnett, curls hanging over one eye, that soft Dublin accent. Nice T-shirts, he adds. Get lost, Mags hisses at Billy. They'll think you're with us. Phil looks at her, and she's got longer hair than me. Longer nails, bigger eyes. We end up in the bumpers. Mags gets stuck in the middle, going round and round in a circle. I nudge my car up against hers. We're in the bumpers with thin Lizzie. On the way downstairs to the cellar bar, Mags grabs and pinches my upper arm. When they ask you what you're drinking, don't say vodka and lime. Say that you'll have a pint. Casual-like. Oh, okay, right. What will you have, girls? A pint. A pint of what? We end up with bottles of beer, pouring them out too fast, the froth ending up on our noses when we try to drink. They laugh at us, and the cold beer tastes sour. Scott Gorham admires my black nail varnish. He's got a sexy American drawl. Brian Robinson is chatting away to Mags. He has hair like David Essex and an accent like Billy Connolly. Back in the dressing room, Phil takes us to one side. What ages are you girls? The guys are wondering. 19, I say. 18, Mag says. Ah, come on now. You can tell Uncle Phil. 19 and she's 18. Really, cross my heart and hope to die. Ah, all right then. Well, what's your favourite song? He asks me. And I want to say, Dear Heart, but that might be a bit vodka and lime. The rocker, I lie. While they're getting changed, we sit on a step outside the dressing room. The support group are raging and screaming. Two guys ask us up to dance. No, sorry, we're with the band. Groupies, they sneer back at us. Lizzie stride onto the stage, gods in black leather. We rush towards the front and the guitars are growling and thumping. We close our eyes and sway. Then, this is for a beautiful Dublin girl. I open my eyes. He's looking right at me. I'm a rocker. I'm a roller too, babe. Afterwards, we go backstage, all set for the sex, drugs and rock and roll. There's a trestle table covered with an oilcloth. And someone has set out tea, sandwiches and iced buns. Phil Linnett is sitting beside a woman with perfect hair and white jeans. A guy from Spotlight keeps chatting me up and I'm trying to look past him to Scott Gorham. Eventually, Scott walks us to the door. You'll come and see us in Dublin? Of course we will. Outside, the street is empty and cold, but Billy is waiting. Do ye realise what time it is? What the hell have you been up to? You're a right pair of feck off. Sure, we were only drinking tea. Mr. McAvoy is waiting on the Donnerill Walk. Your mother is in a knot of worry up there. After the lectures about young ladies, maths revision and wasted dental bills, we slink off to bed. Mags falls asleep, but my ears are thrumming with the twang and scream of that guitar solo and his tender, tender voice. I'm still in love with you.
Aviary. He taps at my window. The gods told me this. In France, they frame a hospital window with a tree and a sky, while in Italy, cats roam the clinic's corridors like medieval lanes, or sharpen their claws on the beds of the dying. This is air, where the alphabet has grown on trees. All I can spell out is a memory, where Satan the seagull has swallowed a semi-rotten fish, green scales, stinking. He taps at my window, and I look down the river where Charon floats his boat. A lonely rat looks up from his infected meal. Hospital food, we agree with a nod, is not for the living. He taps at my hospital window, a big hungry beak with a belly of feathers. I think of the man hugging his tenderness, his small dog sitting in his ghetto window, framed in a drawing by Bruno Schulz, the pet Jew of an art-loving Nazi. Somehow, I hear the sound of a cello being played. I cannot open my window to its melody. My bed is a branch where I sit, waiting to hug a rat and a seagull and cradle my cancer.
On this morning's programme, we heard Never Meet Your Heroes by John Toll, Barefoot Running by Joe Rooney, Nests by Kathy Donaghy, The American Embassy at 60 by Shane O'Toole, We're With the Band by Lanny O'Hanlon, and Aviary, a poem by Judith Mock. The music was the theme tune to The Sunday Game by James Galway, played by the RTE Concert Orchestra. I Feel the Earth Move by Carol King. Wasso Sauvage by Dom Lenena. I Guess the Lord Must Be in New York City by Harry Nielsen. And Dear Heart by Thin Lizzy. And a book you may be interested in, America at Home, The Architecture and Politics of the US Embassy in Dublin by Cormac Murray, with an introduction by Shane O'Toole, will be published by the Phibsborough Press later this summer. And a reminder that Sunday Miscellany returns to the Crescent Arts Centre in Belfast on Sunday the 9th of June as part of the Belfast Book Festival, with writers John Toll, Glenn Patterson, Jan Carson and Lucy Caldwell, with music by vocal ensemble True and more. The Miscellany event is now waiting list only, and you can be added to it at crescentarts.org. And that's where you can also find details of all the other events at the festival. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can listen back to this morning's programme on the RTE radio app, or at the programme website, rte.ie/radio1/Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.